So, who am I talking about? Okay, who am I talking about? He became an emperor at the age of 16. He quickly murdered his stepbrother to eliminate him as a rival. He tried twice unsuccessfully to murder his stepmother, his scheming stepmother, but he did succeed the third time and managed to make it look like suicide. By his early 20s, he's already been married twice and bumped off both wives. Any ideas who I'm talking about? Well, you'll get the next one, I think. It is said that he set his capital city on fire and then played his fiddle while he watched it burn. Any ideas? Nero. And after the fire, he blamed the Christians for the fire and had them persecuted in large numbers. Yes, I'm talking, of course, about Emperor Nero. Now, some of the things I've just said, some historians don't quite agree with. But whatever the truth, it is agreed that Nero was one of the most tyrannical, cruel, immoral, corrupt psychopaths ever to rule a country. And Paul wrote his letter to the Christians in Rome during the time of Nero. Really important. That's the background to what Paul is saying in this letter to the Romans. He wrote it to Christians living through a terrible and tumultuous time. He wrote it to Christians who were probably hanging on to their faith by their fingertips. So hard was it to be a Christian in those days. According to the historian Tacitus, Nero once had Christians tied to stakes, daubed with tar, and set on fire in order to provide illumination for a garden party. I mean, how wicked, how perverse is that? What we do know for sure also is that both the Apostle Peter and Paul were martyred during the reign of Nero. And later, great Roman cities became the venue for some of the most depraved spectacles man has ever devised, including having men and women torn apart by wild animals. It is not for nothing that the Apostle John, in his book of Revelation, described Rome as the Great Babylon, the sort of the most wicked place you could possibly imagine. But the Roman Empire was something of a contradiction. On the one hand, it was one of the most clever, sophisticated, inventive civilizations that had ever been and probably has ever been. But on the other hand, it was also one of the most cruel, brutal, wicked civilizations that the world has ever known. And it seems likely, don't you think, that such things would inevitably color or influence Paul as he wrote this letter to these Christians in Rome who were living in that kind of place. Seems likely, I think, it would color his thinking and his language and what he has to say. The opening chapters of, I've been asked to speak about the opening chapters of the book of Romans, they reflect the hard and difficult times that it was in those days for Christians. For instance, Paul says in chapter 1, verse 18, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against the godlessness and wickedness of men. That sounds a bit strong and a bit negative, but when you think of the background, what people were going through, it's quite mild language, really. Or chapter 1, verse 24, God gave them over to the sinful desires of their hearts. There was no limit as to what these Romans could do in the name of entertainment. Or bear with me for a slightly longer quote, still from chapter 1. Paul says, furthermore, since they did not think it worthwhile to retain a true knowledge of God, God gave them over to a depraved mind to do what ought not to be done. They have become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. They are gossips, slanderers, God-haters. They are arrogant and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. That in itself is quite a good description of the worst aspects of the Roman Empire. They invent ways of doing evil. And he says, they are senseless, faithless, heartless, and ruthless. Wow. What an indictment. What a wicked, awful place Rome must have been. As the famous writer Edward Gibbon said in his great work, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, he wrote this, instead of asking why the Roman Empire was destroyed, we should rather be surprised that it lasted so long. Well, all I can say is that I'm glad I wasn't there. I'm glad I wasn't a Roman in those days. I'm glad I'm not as bad as they were then. Ah, but wait a minute. Wait a minute. There's something here that makes me feel a bit uneasy. Because in amongst the wickedness and the evil and the depravity and the murder, things that I would never do, don't know about you, but I wouldn't. Paul also says, greed, envy, gossip, arrogance, boasting, disobedience. Paul seems to see no distinction between the big sins and the little sins. Maybe this passage has got something to say to me. Because if I'm honest, well, I can sometimes be a bit greedy. And occasionally I do envy what other people have. And well, let's be honest, gossip is a problem for all of us at some time or another, isn't it? I said a few moments ago that Rome was a place of contradiction, capable of great virtue and great vice. And that contradiction lies at the heart of what it means to be human. Everyone is capable of virtue and vice, of goodness and wickedness. As somebody once said, the heart of the human problem is the problem of the human heart. And even St. Paul recognized this contradiction in himself. At some point, I think, in the next 2 or 3 weeks, you'll come on to Romans chapter 7. And I hope I don't incur the wrath of the Reverend Chesworth by just alluding to it now. But this is what Paul wrote about himself a little bit later in the letter. He said, we know that the law is spiritual, but I am unspiritual, sold as a slave to sin. I do not understand what I do, for what I want to do, I do not do, and what I hate, I do. He's pulling his hair out. And again a little later, he says, I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out. For I do not do the good I want to do, but the evil I do not want to do, this I keep doing. We're all a living contradiction, aren't we? To some degree or other, let's be honest. I hope we're not as bad as the Romans were. But we're all indicted in some way or other. And we need to be careful before we pass judgment on others. As it says in chapter 2, you therefore have no excuse, you who pass judgment on someone else, for at whatever point you judge another, you are condemning yourself. Because you who pass judgment do the same things. And to remove any doubt that we all stand in need of the grace of God, Paul says in chapter 3, verse 9, it was the verse that ended our reading, what then shall we say? Are we any better? Not at all. There is no one that is righteous, not even one. The opening chapters, which Aunt Jesuit has very generously given me to preach on, keeping all the better chapters for herself. I'm only joking. But the opening chapters of Romans paint a rather bleak picture of the human race. Chapters 1, 2, 3 are the bad news. There is some good news to come. Just wait till you get round to chapters 5, 6, and 8. But that's for somebody else to preach on. I've been asked to preach about 1, 2, and 3. So what lessons, what takeaways can we get from these early tough chapters of the book of Romans? Well, we're going to have some pictures now. If you can have the first slide up, please, David. Thank you. First point I think we can take away is this. Beware of self-righteousness. Beware of self-righteousness. I don't know about you, but I can sometimes be very, very quick to point out the faults in others, whilst at the same time having a ready excuse for my own faults. I think this is something we all do, isn't it, if we're honest? To quote Edward Gibbon again, he wrote this, "The most worthless of mankind are not afraid to condemn in others the same disorders that they allow in themselves, and can readily discover some nice excuse to justify the distinction." Yes, someone loses their temper, and I say, "Oh, that's terrible. Oh, tut, 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 look at that behavior over there." But when I lose my temper, oh, I've got some excuses all lined up. I was tired. I've been overworked lately. I was provoked. It wasn't really me. No excuses for him over there. Lots of excuses for me. As somebody once said, we should remember that if we point the finger at someone else, there are three fingers pointing back at me. As Christians, we strive, of course, to lead exemplary lives. But in that very striving lies a trap. The trap of self-righteousness. In his book, The Life You've Always Wanted, John Ortberg, an American pastor, writes about the pitfalls of being a committed Christian striving to lead a good life. And he says this, one of the hardest things in the world is to stop being the prodigal son without turning into the self-righteous older brother. I'm going to say that again because I think it's one of the best quotes I've come across for a long time. One of the hardest things in the world is to stop being the prodigal son without turning into the self-righteous older brother. That's the first thing I think we can take away from these early chapters of Romans. Beware of self-righteousness. Secondly, thank you, David. Cultivate a generous spirit. Cultivate a generous spirit. We often don't know, do we, what it is that leads people to think and say and do what they do. We haven't lived in their shoes or had their upbringing. We haven't had the knocks in life that they might have had. We all live by the grace of God and should extend that grace to one another. Some people are truly amazing. I mean, really amazing. They seem to be able to overcome all the setbacks and disadvantages of life that life can throw at them. I'm sure we all know J.K. Rowling, for instance, author of the Harry Potter books. She's a billionaire, and at the moment, probably the world's best-known author. But she grew up in a troubled household. As a young adult, she was an unemployed, single mother who survived on welfare benefits. So she must be an amazing woman. She's currently sold more than 500 million books, and the Harry Potter films have taken nearly $8 billion at the box office. Wow, what a woman. Yeah, some people are amazing. But others are less resilient, less gifted, less independent, and perhaps more prone to being led astray. Whilst I'm preaching here this morning, your minister Anne is preaching at Guiseley Baptist Church. And I know she's preaching from John chapter 4, because that's what I asked her to preach on. Jesus' encounter with the woman at the well. I imagine you'll know the story. And throughout that encounter, we see Jesus exercising empathy and gentleness to this woman, in contrast to the disciples who come along and can't understand why he's even bothering to talk to her. Why are you talking to her, they say. And it's the same in John chapter 8, when the Pharisees brought to Jesus an adulteress. They want her punished. They want her knocked down. But Jesus seeks to lift her up. They want to punish her. Jesus wants to heal her. I think it's a fair generalization to say that in the Gospels, Jesus' harshest words were aimed at religious people and not at the so-called sinners. And there has to be a lesson for us there. We are called to cultivate a generous spirit. Some Christians, you know, can be so horrible to other people, including Christians towards other Christians, that you would think we had never heard of the Lord's Prayer. How does it go? Forgive us our sins, as we forgive those who sin against us. It's not rocket science, is it? But at times, it's really hard to put into practice. So beware of self-righteousness. That's one thing to take away from the book of Romans. And cultivate a generous spirit is another thing to take away. Thank you, David. Thirdly, embrace the way of Jesus. Embrace the way of Jesus. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus reinterpreted the Ten Commandments. He appealed not just to the letter of the law, but also to the spirit of the law. Of course, we ought not to murder anybody. Not much discussion about that. But Jesus said we shouldn't even get angry with people. And we shouldn't even call people a fool. Oh, how many times have I said to people, you idiot? I bet some of you have said that as well. Jesus said, it's not exactly like murder, but he holds us to a different standard. Of course we should not commit adultery, but Jesus said we should not look lustfully at another. Of course we should love our friends, but Jesus said, do you want to be different? Love your enemies. That's different, and that's what I want you to do. Love your enemies. It's not easy all the time, but we should embrace the way of Jesus in all that we do. Beware of self-righteousness. Cultivate a generous spirit. And embrace the way of Jesus. I'm going to close with a little story that kind of sums up what I've been trying to say this morning. Polycarp was a bishop in the early church in a place called Smyrna. It is now the modern city of Izmir in Turkey. And Polycarp lived to be 86 years old. In fact, he was the last person that we know of to have known one of the apostles, the Apostle John. So he goes back to within touching distance of Jesus, certainly within touching distance of the apostles. In the year 155, a squad of soldiers were sent to arrest him. The soldiers were amazed that so many of them had been sent to arrest a frail old man. And they were even more amazed when Polycarp said to them, "Ah, you men must be tired from your journey. Sit down, let's have something to eat and drink before we set off back to town." So they sat down and he fed them and he watered them and he cared for them. And then the time came to go back to town. So they arrested him and took him back into town. And there the authorities tried hard to persuade him to deny Jesus and to honor the gods. But Polycarp said, 86 years I have served Jesus, and he has never done me any harm. How then can I now blaspheme my King and my Savior?" There was no self-righteousness in Polycarp, and he certainly had a generous spirit. And without doubt, he embraced the way of Jesus. A few moments of quiet.